You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. Thank you very much for being here. I'm Kevin Casasamora. I'm a senior fellow in foreign policy, as well as the acting director of the Latin American Initiative here at Brookings. Over the past couple of years, since the economic downturn started, a lot of attention has been devoted to the issue of the robustness of the financial systems in Latin America and how they weathered the crisis remarkably well, and how that shows that financial supervision has really made very important strides in the region. In the course of this discussion, much less attention has been paid to other aspects connected to the financial system in the region, particularly to the issue of access to financial services, which when you take a closer look at the evidence, and we will do so in the course of this discussion, what you find is that access to financial services in Latin America is surprisingly limited in a number of ways. Why is that so? I mean, that's a very critical question for the region. But it's not the only question. I mean, what is the role of financial access in development? What is the relationship of financial access with pervasive informality in the region? What is the role, and this is something that we've been approaching from different sides, the relationship of financial aspects in terms of the growth of middle classes, the expansion of the middle classes that is taking place in the region? I mean, can you belong to the middle class without having access to financial services on a daily basis? And this is particularly interesting given the fact that, and this is something that kind of puzzles me, home ownership in the region tends to be very, very extended. So the relationship between financial access and expansion of the middle classes. And last but not least, the issue of the role that public banks, publicly owned banks, state-owned banks can play in improving access to financial services. I remember up until not so long ago, the ownership of banks by states in Latin America was very much discouraged. Well, they seem to be back in vogue. And the financial crisis has put state-owned banks under a more positive light. So what's the role of public banks in terms of improving financial access in Latin America? So there are a lot of very interesting and very timely questions around this this discussion. And we are very fortunate to rely, in order to answer those questions, to rely on the knowledge and the expertise of the Andean Development Bank, of CAF, La Corporación Andina de Fomento, that happened to have published an extraordinarily thorough report on the issue of financial access in Latin America. And they're going to share the results of that very comprehensive research here with us today. Our partnership with CAF is one that we are very proud of because it's been very productive over the past couple of years. We've done a very significant amount of things. And it goes to showing, in my view, the greater role that CAF seems to be playing in the region every day. And part of the reason why it's improving its role and its standing and its presence in the region is because it has this knack for posing very important questions. And not just posing the questions, but also guiding its policies and its lending to the region by the results of the questions it poses. It's a partnership that we certainly would like to continue well into the future. So we're very happy to do this event, to co-host this event with CAF. To answer all those questions and several others, we have an exceptionally accomplished group of speakers. First of all, we have the distinct pleasure of having here the lead author, the academic coordinator of the report, Dr. Paolo Sanguinetti, who's to my immediate right. He's the socioeconomics research director at CAF, and he also serves as professor of economics at University Torquato di Tella in Buenos Aires. To my, the next one to the right is Dr. Liliana Rojas Suarez, who hails from just across the corner, across the street, sorry. She's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, and she also currently serves, and this is very germane to the discussion today, she serves as the president of the Latin American Shadow Financial Regulatory Committee, CLAF. Last but not least, we have Dr. Sergio Smokler, who's a lead economist at the World Bank, and that's only the last stage of a very successful policymaking and academic career. He's worked at the U.S. Federal Reserve Board, the Inter-American Development Bank Research Department, and the Argentine Central Bank, among many, many, many other leading institutions. So we have the right people to lead the discussion and to ask and perhaps, if you're very lucky, answer some of the very interesting questions that this issue of financial access poses for the future of the region. Without further ado, the floor is yours, Paolo. And last but not least, since all our speakers prepared PowerPoints, PowerPoint presentations, I would definitely encourage you to move to the front so you can see the details of the presentation. There's plenty of room here in the front. Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here. I also want to thank Liliana and Sergio for agreeing to be here as discussants. It's nice to be in Washington, especially with the good weather. So as Kevin was saying, this is our 2011 report that deals with financial access. But let me tell you that we have been doing this kind of development reports in the last 5 years. We have worked on issues related to growth, to trade, to infrastructure, to social policies, local development, etc. This year is, as Kevin was saying, on financial access and the financial system. This book, of course, I have a little bit of time, 30 minutes. Oh, okay, you tell me 5 minutes before. It's a lengthy book. We have 6 chapters. Let me tell you about the structure, and then I'm going to do a very summary of the main results. We have a first chapter, which is, of course, to motivate the book about why is that financial inclusion is important for development and welfare. And then we start with an overview about some macro measures of financial deepening and financial inclusion in Latin America using secondary sources of data. Then we go in detail about SMEs, you know, small and medium enterprise access to finance, especially to credit, and why this is important in terms of, you know, investment decision, employment, etc. Then we go to the smallest firms, you know, micro enterprises, and, you know, we deal with all this movement of microfinance in the region that has been so important. And then in chapter 5, we look at on the household side. So the previous 2 chapters deals with formal firms and micro entrepreneurs. This chapter 5 goes to the household side, looking at, you know, access to financial services is good not only for credit, but for many other services, many other things like, you know, doing taxation, savings, etc. So we do that in chapter 5. And finally, as Kevin was saying, we look at how public banks have deal with this idea of helping people to get access to financial services. And so we surveyed, there are some interesting experiences of some public banks, and we put a lot of emphasis in the sense that those public banks that have worked, they seem to have an institutional kind of design, more type of corporate governance that is very good to assure the good results. So this is the whole thing. Let me start as a motivating, as a way of motivation, to look at some data on the relationship between financial deepening. This is a laser, isn't it? Okay, good. Financial deepening and development. So in here we have a data on this measure of financial deepening, which is, you know, credit to the private sector over GDP, the traditional measure of financial development. Okay. And here we have income per capita in long term. So, of course, we have this positive relationship that suggests that, development comes in, you know, very, is correlated with income levels. But of course, this relationship goes either way in the sense that you may think that as country develops because of technology development, because of productivity, etc., income grows. Of course, you have a lot of increased demand for financial services. But, you know, it goes the other way around too. You know, greater access to credit, to, let's say, insurance, etc., produces increases in productivity, you know, fosters investment that, of course, increase income levels. So this is a two-way relationship that you have observed in the data. You see here, but anyway, these countries here are most of Latin America. So, this graph seems to say that for the income level of these countries, the level of financial deepening that they have is lower than compared to the whole of the countries behave. So it already signals some sort of low financial development in the region, in Latin America, compared to other regions. The only countries that are, you know, beyond the line is Panama and Chile, that have a much more developed financial system. Here is... it's a more detailed the data on Latin America. And the only thing that I want you to look at here is that, you know, these are the income per capita in PPP dollars, 2005. And this is, again, the credit to the private sector of GDP. So you see, the idea to have a financial system that is developed, that is, you know, is working well, is not just, it doesn't depend only on the size of the economy. You have big economies, large economies, like, let's say, Argentina, Mexico, with a level of financial, you know, credit to the private sector below 20% of GDP. And on the other hand, you have, very small countries like, let's say, Bolivia, with a ratio of credit to the private sector to GDP of over 40. So, you know, it's not just, you know, that as you get a bigger, you get a, you know, larger financial system. It's not always the same. So, of course, behind this is the fact that you have to have a more stable macroeconomic environment, etc., that some of these countries, let's say Argentina and Mexico, they don't have it. I mean, they have a lot of financial crisis, etc. So here is in more detail, you know, a disaggregation of within the total credit to the private sector. You have like credit by the banks. So you say you compare Latin America to East Asia and OECD's countries, and you see that in most of these measures of financial deepening, say credit by private banks, deposit in the financial system, capitalization of stock exchange, capitalization of private bond market, etc., Latin America lags compared to Asian countries, and of course to OECD countries. Only in capitalization of public bonds is where Latin America is get closer to other regions. And of course, this is because many of our governments have used a lot the public bonds as a way to financing. But, you know, so far the measures that I show you are measures of, as I call it, financial deepening, which is a measure of total credit of the private sector, to the private sector of the GDP. But this aggregate measure doesn't tell us who's getting the credit. I mean, in terms of, we are much more interested in the extensive margin of financial development, in the sense that we are going to say that the financial system is more developed when more families and firms are getting the financial services. Okay? And this is very different to measure the total, you know, credit over GDP. So here is a measure of financial access, which is built by the World Bank, and it's represented percentage of adult population with a bank account. And of course, again, we have a positive relationship between the income per capita, this is in logs, and this measure of financial access. But again, you see, Latin American countries are, most of them, below the line that draws the average behavior of all the countries in the world. Even Chile, when we measure the financial deepening, was above the line. It's just over the line here. So you may say that in terms of financial access, Latin America is even more, is lagging. The problem of access is more serious compared to financial deepening. So to investigate this more deeply, we ran a survey. We conducted a survey on 17 Latin American cities. It was a, house-by-house service in which we asked people what type of financial services they use. So this is a first measure of financial access, which is the percentage of population that have an account, a bank account. You know, this includes not only formal banks, but includes microfinancial institutions, credit unions, etc. So our measure of financial access, of bank account access is 51% of the population on average in these 17 Latin American cities have access to a bank account, which is very low. Okay, which is very low. Not only that, from those people that have not a bank account, 38% do not know how, the requirements to open a bank account. So you have not only low financial, financial access in terms of bank account, but also very low financial literacy. With this data, we also try to study whether this problem of financial, access in terms of, in this case, have a bank account, depends on income of families. So here we have the data on percentage of population with a bank account as for different level of income per capita. This is in dollars per month. Okay? So, as you see, there is a positive relationship between, income per capita, income, or family income, and access to a bank account. But compared to, let's say, a developed country like U.S., this is the data for U.S., the same thing, here, the positive relationship is positive, but it's not as steep as in the case of U.S. In here, people around, earn $800 per month or more already are, bankerized, already have a bank account. In Latin America, with $1,000 income, a little bit more than 60% of the people have bank account. And, $1,000 income monthly is medium high class income level in Latin America. So the conclusion is that it's not a problem of low level of incomes. So behind the low access to, the financial system is not only a problem of poverty, of low incomes. Even rich people in our region somehow has no access to financial services. Okay? So, so far I discussed the very simple measure of financial services, like have a bank, have a bank account in the financial system. In here we look at saving instruments. So we ask people whether, first, if they save in some kind of instrument, and 63% of the people save in the region. So even poor families have some type of savings. But how much of these people save through the financial system? Only 25% of the population save in the financial system, or 63% of the people that report some savings. Of this 63% of the people, 55%, for example, save saving accounts. 33% only use the financial system, let's say, saving account to to operate those savings. 55% save just in cash. 22% save using durable goods. Okay? So again, you see how even though people in the region, even poor people, do have some savings, they don't use the financial system to do that. What about credit? In here, you see only a little bit of 20% of the people have some credit standing or loans, 20%. So 20% report receiving some form of loans. Of these, only 65% have a loan for a formal financial system institution. So only 12.5% of the household have a credit from the financial system. So this is again seems to be very, very, very low. Okay, and many people have loans from families and from money lenders, almost 20%. So you see an extended use of informal credit. So again, if we want to analyze this in terms of income, so here we have, you know, formal credit as depending on income levels. So this is 10% of the low income families. This is, you know, 10% of the high income families. And of course, we have a positive relationship between access to credit and where you are in the income distribution. Okay? So the rich people have much more access to credit than the poor people, but how much more? You know, this is 8%. So, you know, 8% of the families in the low income level have some kind of access to formal credit. The rich families, 22% of those rich families have access to formal credit. So again, a positive relationship, but it's not, the curve is not that steep. Meaning, that the problem of access to financial services is not only a thing of the poor families, that affect the poor families. Here we constructed the same thing, but putting all the Latin American families in the, you know, to construct just one distribution of income. So here we have the poorest in Latin America. Here are the richest in Latin America. So here we have the, I don't know, the richest in Chile, for example. Okay? You see, in here, when we put all Latin Americans in a single distribution, the relationship is not even positive. Why? Because here are the, you know, the rich guys in Argentina that have no credit at all because, you know, the credit system was shut during, let's say, like 2 years, you know? So that's why you have this kind of negative relationship. Again, saying that behind the determinant of credit is, of course, not only your personal characteristics, but also the macro of the country, the institution of the country, etc. Now, so far I have dealing with access to financial services by households. But, of course, financial services is very important to, you know, for productivity purposes. Here we have data on micro enterprises, in the sense, how important are micro enterprises for income support for families in Latin America? So here, 25% of the families in Latin America report that their main income comes from a micro enterprise they have. Okay? So, and this is important, for example, in Bolivia, 31%. In Peru, 30%. So it is a very important source of income. This productive activity within the family using a micro enterprise. So how many of these families that are, you know, are micro enterprises, have micro enterprises, have access to credit? Well, only 40% of these micro enterprises have access to credit in 2010. So the idea is that and this, of course, is different across countries. In Bolivia and Peru, which are the countries in which microfinance institutions were more developed, you see much more that families there, or microenterprises here, have much more access to credit. 25% in Bolivia and 22% in Peru. But, for example, let's say in Argentina, it's only 5%. of these micro enterprises have access to formal credit. When I say formal credit, it's credit coming from NGOs, from credit unions, microfinance institutes, etc., not only formal banks, okay? So the idea is, where are these micro enterprises get credit if they don't get it from the formal system? Well, they use a lot of, you know, money launderers, informal sources. This is data for Colombia. There is a survey of micro enterprises there. And this is just to tell you that 41% of the micro establishment in Colombia have outstanding contract with informal and sources of funding. So this here, here, here. Not only that, 26% have of this micro establishment combine formal and informal sources. So what the interesting thing to think about is that even though the microfinance development has loan access to these micro enterprises, still they go to the, you know, money lenders. And many firms do the two things at the same time. And this is a kind of surprising. Why? Because the difference in the rate of interest. You know, while money lenders charge you like 270% per year interest, you know, a credit union charge you 24%, or a bank, of course, 23%, or, an NGO, 17%. So it's interesting to see that these two sources of loans, of credit, are combined in micro establishments, even though they have so different interest rates. So in the book, we ask ourselves, why is that, you know, you still have those guys lending to this micro enterprise at these rates? And of course, I don't have time to go into detail, but the question is that maybe microfinance institutions, even though they ask a lot of fewer requirements to get credit to the micro enterprises, still, they are a little bit, the contracts are kind of not very flexible. And instead, the money lenders have a much more flexibility in their contracts. So that is why that micro establishment goes there, even though they are much more expensive. So let me go now to the formal enterprises, not micro enterprises, but formal enterprises, bigger, larger. So in here you see the data. This is data from the World Bank. You see that this is an indicator of how many firms have access to credit. And Latin America, when you look at formal firms, 47% of the firms have an outstanding loan, okay, with the formal system. So this compares not too bad with emerging Asia or other developing regions, even though it's much lower than compared to OECD countries. Still, the important thing to observe is that there is a difference in terms of access to credit between small firms and large firms, which have much more credit access to credit. Okay. So here is there are some data again, you know, comparing some countries. Chile, one of the countries that has the most developed financial system, on average, 70% of the firms have some outstanding loan from the formal financial system. You look at Argentina, 40%. Look at Mexico, 12%. This looks like an African country, you see? So again, you can have a large economy and still have a very low underdeveloped financial system. And look at Bolivia and Peru, they have higher levels compared to Argentina and Mexico, and this is because of for example, the development of microfinance institutions. The important thing is, again, the difference between large and small firms. In Argentina, it's 3 times larger, the access to credit of large firms compared to small firms. So here is a problem. In here, I look at data from the Observatorio PYME in Argentina, again, to understand the question of how if firms have access to credit. For example, for this data, you see that 30% of the firms have asked for a loan. have requested a loan. So the problem of lack of access is not a problem that the banks say no to firms. Many firms do not ask for a loan, you know, expecting that they will be, you know, turned down. So part of the problem is that many firms are not going to the financial system. Because once you ask for a loan, the rate of approval is not that bad. It's 80%. But of course, the problem is that there is the ones that go there go with the, you know, with a financial statement, etc., that assures them that the loan will be approved. Okay, so the important thing is whether this lack of loan has any consequence in terms of economic performance. And you see, 32% of the firms say that, this lack of funding have stopped investing. Okay? So it seems that this problem of access to credit has real consequence in terms of investment decision. And this is also shown for Colombia. Here we have data for firms that are former firms of size 10 workers or more. Okay? And we have separated firms that have liquidity restrictions and those that do not have liquidity restrictions. So, for example, those firms that have liquidity restrictions in the sense that they have no access to loans from banks, you see that the investment decision is highly correlated with cash flow. So they invest when they have cash, okay? Not only that, of course, these firms that have liquidity restrictions are smaller in terms of employment and also sales, etc. And more important, they grow at a lower rate. So these are the firms that do not have problem accessing to credit. They grew on average 8.6% per year between 1987 and 2007. Those firms that have problem of access to credit, they grew just 2.2%. So you see how the problem of access to credit has real consequence in terms of investment, production, etc. So, if we understand or we say that firms have problems for accessing to credit, what kind of public policy can be, you know, designed to solve these problems? Well, of course, there are a lot of arguments in the sense that the financial system are subject to market failures, you know, problems of asymmetric information, problems of moral hazard, problems to enforce the debt contract. So all these market failures generates or justifies the idea that there could be a public interventions. Okay, so but how this intervention should be designed? Well, the first thing is that it is good that if you try to intervene in the financial system, it's good that the intervention is associated with a market failure. So for example, if you suppose that small firms cannot access to credit because they don't have backup, they don't have, collaterals. So, okay, a market intervention geared at giving them these firms collateral, like, for example, guarantees, is good because it goes directly to a problem that you identify as a market failure. Okay? If the problem is that the lack of information about good and bad, creditors, so an intervention that tries to generate more information in the market is a good policy. And for example, you have credit rating agencies. You can promote those to solve that problem. So again, if you can, a good policy is a one that you can associate with a specific market failure. Okay? A second element to justify intervention and to make good policy is that implementation of these measures is good that they do it in cooperation with the private banking. Why is this so? Because this helps you to reach sharing, to add more resources, and also reduce operation costs. So in many countries, as you will see, some interventions to support credit to the small firms have been done in cooperation of the public and the private sector. Which agent within the state should be in charge of this public policy? Well, I'm not going to discuss this, but many of these, some of these interventions have been implemented by public banks. So we'll talk about that later on. Okay, so what kind of public intervention had been developed to solve this problem of access to financial services? Well, first of all, you will see that recently the state has gradually stopped granting loans directly. It had worked as a second tier level. So it develops some funds and resources that then they use the private banking to implement the thing. So the recent trend is that the state is not longer giving directly the funds. What type of instrument? Well, for example, you see credit and access to capital market for small enterprises, especially those that are, are those that try to innovate. So the idea that you need credit for these firms to support the creation of firms that are very innovative. For example, Nafin's Corfo in Chile has done a lot on that. Okay? So, because many times you cannot create a firm that is already in debt, you see? So you have to give the firm capital, not a loan. So for innovative firms, you need raise capital. You don't need capital through loans. So that's why these Corfo, programs in Corfo are very important. Then, of course, you have guarantee schemes, which of course directly attacks the problem of access to finance due to lack of collateral. And again, there are very good successful cases in the region, FOGAPE in Chile, the Fondo Nacional de Garantía in Colombia, FOGAPE in Argentina. Then they have this factoring thing, the idea that that many small firms are, suppliers of big firms, so the idea that the big firm can act as supporting the loan of the small firm. This is the factoring thing. And then you have also, Afinsa has been very, very successful in this thing. And also, as I told you before, credit bureaus, which are also very important. For example, Galindo have wrote a paper in which it shows how the thing that this credit rating agency have developed in the region have helped small and medium enterprises to get credit compared to countries in which do not have these credit rating agencies. Okay. Let me tell you that many of these instruments to support financial access to small and medium enterprises, but also to families, have been implemented by public banks in the region. For example, again, Nafinsa in Mexico, but Banco do Brasil in Brazil, Banco Index in Colombia, Cofide in Peru. So the idea is that that you have this, I would say, new version of public bank development banks in the region that have implemented many of these interventions to support credit to small and medium firms. Many of these public banks have focused on funding, projects which are much more risky in terms of innovation, etc. But to assure that you do that in the right way, you have to generate a lot of capacities in these public banks to understand, you have to be specialists in those banks that knows the sector, knows, the productive characteristics of some sectors. They know and have cooperation, and they know who are the key actors in the productive area of the country. But not only that, they need to cooperate with the private banking. This is very important. Well, these private banks, these public banks are funded many times not by deposit, but also by, raising capital in the markets. You cannot fund, high risky enterprises using deposit as backing. It's very risky, So that's why this developing public bank have used the capital market to raise capital. Okay. Public banks have not been also important for, access to credit, act as development bank to promote investment in innovation, etc. But also as public commercial banks to to give services, financial services, to poor families or areas, you know, remote areas in the countries. So this was also important. For example, Banco do Brasil played a role. What we analyze in the book is that, in any case, second-tier public banks or even first-floor public banks, I mean commercial banks, to assure that they work well, you need a kind of internal institution, internal arrangement, that so isolate those banks from the political pressures. They give incentive to, you know, to employees to enhance productivity, etc. And for this is important that they got what we call it rules of corporate governance. So in the last chapter of the book, we measure corporate governance indicators for these public banks, and we show that even there are some cases that have been very successful, like Cofide, for example, in Peru. Still, many public banks in the region need to implement those corporate rules and need to improve their internal institutional ruling so that they are truly isolated from public, you know, from political pressures, etc. Well, let me conclude saying that household access to financial services in Latin America is low and cannot be justified just by low income levels. The problems of, you know, access to financial services affect a vast proportion of the population, not only low-income families, but middle-income families and even high-income families. On the productive front, let me tell you that despite improvement in the two decades in the microcredit institutions, still there are a lot of micro enterprises that have not access to credit, and many of those micro establishments go to the, you know, to informal sources of funds interest rates are so high, 10 times higher than the formal financial system. And why is this so? In the book, we suggest that the problem is that still the microfinance institution, develop contracts that lack some kind of flexibility compared to the informal sources of funds. In the case of formal firms, in particular small and medium enterprises, we identify product of great relevance that can help these small and medium enterprises to get some credit. And we mention guarantee schemes, venture capital, factoring, specialized stock exchange, among others. Finally, the report discusses very useful experiences with the public banking, that have helped to expand financial services to, again, poor families, small firms, and even micro enterprises. But these experiences of the public banks need to be analyzed with care because for those banks to work well, they need some kind of internal institutions and rules that, again, assures that they will be isolated for political pressures and they stick to their to their objectives. That the objectives of the public banks, of course, are not only to, you know, make profits, you know, they are development banks, but it's important that even this development bank, if they have objectives that are beyond making profit, they should be clearly, you know, specified in terms of access, etc. So this public bank's manager knows what, you know, why, how is that going to be evaluated? Okay, so this is also important. So thank you very much. Sorry for the time.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Thank you to Kevin for the invitation and Pablo, of course, for the presentation. I've been fortunate to have been involved in the production of this report throughout the entire production cycle, actually. And so I've been following. There is much more in the report than actually Pablo has been able to present. So I really encourage you to read it. I am going to focus on a couple of things in the report and some other research that I've been doing to complement what Pablo just presented. In particular, I want to underscore something, kind of a trend that has been happening in Latin America over the 2000s, and is that really this report has started to put together a number of other efforts that have been taking place by other multilateral organizations, including the Inter-American Development Bank, CEGIP, which is the Secretaría General Iberoamericana in Spain, led by Enrique Iglesias, and the Federation of Latin American Banks. All of them have, with the cooperation of CAF always, and that's the interesting point, that CAF has always been accompanying the production of these studies, have been advancing our knowledge on financial access. And in this area, one of the most important challenges is the continuous provision of information. Actually, this study and the survey, and I am honestly, for those of you who are really interested in the subject, I encourage you to try to use the survey, the data in the survey, because for those of us who do research on this issue, that is the most important limitation, data. Okay, and the survey that CAF has produced could have very important impact for policy-making decisions. I want to put forward two examples of the importance of the report. The first one is the role. I mean, this is an issue that apparently is kind of separate from the issue of financial access, but it's not, and that's what I want to show. The CAF survey focused on results on major cities in Latin America, okay? And there is a recent report by McKinsey that tried to underline which are the most important obstacles to competitiveness in the largest cities in Latin America. And basically, their sample, McKinsey sample, is the same sample, not to say exactly the same, but overlaps significantly with that of CAF. And what the McKinsey report is showing is that cities, large cities, I'm talking Sao Paulo, Bogota, Lima, Caracas, are facing important obstacles for their development. I'm going to make the connection with access in a second. And one of those obstacles is reflected in the fact that large cities are growing below the national average. So smaller cities have started to grow much faster than larger cities. But this is not because the large cities have exhausted the benefits of economies of scale. So because you could drive the conclusion, oh, it's good that small cities have started to grow faster than large cities. But that's not the issue. The issue is that the large cities are facing important obstacles to growth. Still, there is much more economies of scale that they could benefit from, and they are not, because they're facing severe bottlenecks. Now, the connection, oops, what did I do? Sorry. Okay, I messed it up. Just when I was going to give the punchline. Okay. I was saying that large cities are focusing significant bottlenecks for their development, and the McKinsey study concludes that the development of large cities is key for Latin America. But what the most important point that I was trying to make is that among the bottlenecks is the lack of access, of financial access, many basic services, but they underline financial access as a major barrier. So this is very complementary to the results that the study by CAF has been deriving. But even, you know, to show you how looking from different angles, you get kind of the same results, McKinsey information, the numbers itself, coincide very much with those of CAF. For example, in their analysis, with the exception of Santiago, 61% or less of the population have savings account in the sample of large cities under study by McKinsey. It's not exactly the same as in CAF, because cities like Caracas, La Paz, Quito, and Panama, which have larger proportion of access, are actually not included in McKinsey. So, okay, McKinsey did this study once, right? CAF has done this study. I have developed it quasi-career in trying to convince CAF to keep updating these results because, you know, once and for all data is definitely not enough. I know they're updating part of it, but I would like to see more. And so every forum that Pablo invites me, I'm going to be saying the same thing. So, and why I'm so interested in that? Because I personally have, among many others, done research on the issue of access. And the most important constraint that we as researchers find is that we are forced to do cross-sectional studies. Because of lack of continuous data, we have not been able to do too much access studies on using time series data, because there are no comparable data. So let me give you some of the results that I've been getting from other studies that complement what CAF have been doing. A good part of the CAF study talks about the different obstacles for financial access. Okay, it's spread, it's in one chapter, but then it's spread throughout the entire book. Okay, so what, in a combination with work by Carmen Reinhardt and from Peterson and Francisco Basket from the IMF, we did a study that collected a combination of data from country data, World Bank data, and the famous Honohan study on financial access for those countries that we couldn't get more updated information. And then we actually tried to estimate what were the most important obstacles to financial access when the indicator is the percentage of adults that use some form of financial service from the financial sector, okay? And these two pies try to basically summarize the result from a lot of regression analysis, okay? There were a number of variables there, but basically we could say that the most important obstacles to financial access could be divided as between macroeconomic factors, institutional factors, social factors, and factors related to the performance of the financial system. Now, macroeconomic factors are issues such like financial stability, of course, right? I mean, in Latin America, the fact that countries have been facing so many crises, it has been an obstacle for regulators to actually try to even promote further access. Institutional factors have to do with issues such as the credit bureaus, for example, information, respect to the rule of law. Social factors have to do with, okay, the capacity of somebody to be able to have financial literacy, health, education, income inequalities there too. And factors related to the performance of the financial system relates more to, okay, what are those characteristics of the banking system itself and of the regulatory framework that actually are conducive to improve financial access? And we divided the analysis in two sets of countries. In the world, in the developing country world, middle-income countries and low-income countries. And we have some interesting results. For example, notice that the green proportion there, which is the social factors, is basically the most important obstacle to, and again, here I have basic issues. In social factors are issues such as education, the level of education, income inequalities there. I mean, that's an issue that you've been discussing a lot in the report, Pablo. But it's more important in, a little bit more important in middle-income countries than in low-income countries. Very consistently, lack of institutions is more important in low-income countries than in middle-income countries. So if you have a country, for example, like Honduras, institutions is much more important than in a country like Brazil as an obstacle for access. If we move ahead and do the same thing but for a set of countries in Latin America, okay, again, just the four different obstacles and then the six key countries in the region, you're also going to see important differences. Very interestingly, in Chile, social factors really dominate. Now, remember that this is, okay, these are my obstacles, and now I'm going to form a pie and tell you what percentage of these different factors are a constraint to access. Chile could have more access than the other countries. But for that part that doesn't have access, the social elements are the ones that are constraining more the financial inclusion. And so I don't want to spend too much time. I know I'm almost on my time limit. But the issue here is that you can identify different kind of obstacle for different set of countries and within set of countries. But you can only do this on a cross-sectional basis, like we did in this study. If I want to know now whether all the programs that are being in place in Latin America are indeed facilitating access or not, how do I do it? Well, I will use the CAF survey. Okay, what if in 2 years from now I want to do the same thing? How can I assess, make an assessment about progress? We can't, because we do not have a continuous access to this form of information. So to finalize, and this is a little bit of propaganda for what we've been doing next door at the Center for Global Development, we also have a program on access. And so in addition to econometric work and to what the different kind of studies that the CAF, the IDB, the World Bank are doing, we have also doing a study that is based on analyzing different initiatives for access. And we are using a framework, and you have a paper that is being distributed outside that is called Policy Principles for Expanding Financial Access. And basically, this is kind of a complement. Basically, this tells regulators and supervisors, if you want to assess whether your program will facilitate access or not, tell me whether it follows the principles that we have identified. And in this, for constructing these principles, we actually put together a set of experts on access and financial regulation, because that's a point that Pablo didn't emphasize enough, but is in the report about the complementarity between access and financial stability. And so we really have first-class experts around the world, that including in this task force that produced this report. So once again, congratulations to CAF and to Pablo, but please, we need more.
Thank you very much all for coming. Thank you very much, Pablo and Kevin, for the invitation to be here. It's a pleasure to present. Let me give you a little bit of a different perspective of my take on the report. In general, I believe that it's a great report. It's worth reading. It's very, very timely, as everybody has emphasized here. It has lots of useful information and insights, which makes it enjoyable. And also, the authors ought to be congratulated. From my part, I think I mostly agree with the analysis and many of the conclusions. And it has very nice detail and new evidence on issues of access to finance. But let me try to just to create some debate, focus here on the part side. I don't agree completely on the author's take on the evidence. I'm playing a little bit of devil's advocate. Just to qualify, I might have a biased view in the sense that we have our own flagship report. Francisco Ceballos is here, has been part of the team. So from working on these issues, on this report and research I have done over the years, I have a little bit of a different take. I mean, I don't have definite conclusions. Kevin mentioned that we might have many answers. I think we have more questions than answers based on this research. And that's why I think we need to, as Liliana mentioned, we need to do more. So in terms of in general terms, I fully agree that with the conclusion that Latin America is financially underdeveloped. But I have a different take on the overall evidence. The CAF report is basically centered on access to finance, and it gives the flavor that problems of access are severe. My own reading of the general evidence is that it's difficult to conclude that there is a real problem of access. We show that there is a lack of access. Financial services are not being provided to many firms and households. We don't know if that's a problem. Although Pablo mentioned, yes, we know that many firms don't apply for credit in Latin America. Maybe they are not applying for good reasons. Or even if they get rejected, they might be rejected for good reasons. So the fact that many firms are not being serviced doesn't mean that there is a problem. I mean, I still believe that there is something there, and problem of access is usually something that people mention when there is a problem in the financial system that is not delivering the services that they should be delivering, and that's putting a constraint on growth, investment, etc. We don't have the evidence for that. Even the evidence, I think, that is most compelling from the report that Pablo mentioned, the evidence from Colombia that Marcela Melendez put together of the growth of firms with and without constraint on access. They are the issues of causality. You don't know what is going on. Maybe the firms that are not receiving financing is because they are growing less to begin with. And that's why you have this separation. So we don't know whether there is a real problem or not. We see that things are lagging in Latin America in many respects. In other respects, I think they are not that bad, as the report suggests. So what I would try to show here is some data that we have compiled just to give you a different flavor of the data. And I think that there are several nuances of the data. I think overall, LAC has made much progress in financial development, even though we are, in general terms, when you look at the aggregates, very behind. But also the challenges that LAC faces with the financial sector are not unique. Many regions in the world face these type of problems. Firms from all over the world complain that they're not having access to finance, and that part of those complaints are real. And financial services have developed significantly in LAC, even though we see this low level of financial development, particularly for collateralized lending and services. I think many banks are improving there. And it's also hard to know how much financing should go to firms, as I was mentioning before. And it's hard to know what is the right model of financial development that we should try to foster from the public sector. Consumer finance in general seems to be relatively well developed in Latin America. And as I said, I still fully agree that the financial system is not working at least as expected. And also there is here a very difficult trade-off. Kevin started the a conversation talking about financial stability, that Latin America has done better in recent years. And there is a clear trade-off between trying to develop the financial system and having risk of financial crisis. And where to stand on that trade-off is also a difficult challenge. But let me go through some of the graphs just to give you a different flavor of the evidence that I see. And then I'll conclude and we can have a discussion. So the points I will mention are two, with respect to two parts. One is on the overall financial system. I think there is, even though Latin America lacks, there is a large heterogeneity across the countries in Latin America. The outlook is not that bad in Latin America for financial large corporations. I think large corporations are doing well. There are, as Pablo mentioned, more informal channels of credit. So looking at just the financial sector is not enough to understand what is going on in terms of financing activity. In Latin America also has been migrating the financial activity to the international financial system. So there is a lot of offshoring. So just by looking at what is going on in the domestic financial systems in Latin America, it's only part of the financing that is going on to Latin American firms. And also in SME financing, even though the levels are low, I think there has been a lot of changes recently that is are favoring SMEs. And also, I have a different take on the conclusions on the evidence on access to finance. My impression is that Latin America, I mean, Pablo mentioned a lot of evidence based on the surveys, my impression is that Latin America is not lagging in terms of the use of financial services relative to other regions, although it is true that in Latin America things seem to be more expensive than elsewhere. Let me go fast to some scattered evidence just to give you a flavor. In the, relative to this, for example, bond markets. Bond markets in general has been small, but if one looks at the total amount issued per year, percent of GDP in private bonds, Chile is much, much larger in terms of activity in the corporate bond market than the rest. So you see the large heterogeneity there. And in terms of, for example, a total listings in financial in equity markets, one sees a decline here in the Brazilian Bovespa, but there is the Novo Mercado that is taking off since 2001. So Brazil is, in terms of equity markets, is doing relatively well with respect to others. If one looks at the concentration, that's something that we emphasize in the financial activity. The financial activity, even though it might be small, is very concentrated in very few firms. So it's very few that access this. And that happens all over the world. So this is concentration by top five issues in the bond market. So in Latin America, it's 50%. Of the all the issues have been done just by five issues in each year. Asia is similar, but also in G7 is 33%, and other advanced countries is 70%. The share of concentration in equity markets, what is the share of amount raised in equity markets on the top five issues? Again, Latin America recently, 92% is concentrated. Only five issues concentrate total activity per year. This concentration in domestic trading, and for example, you look at Latin America, top five companies capture 60% of the market. So the activity that is going on, it just goes to very few firms in the capital market activity. But that is a feature that is not just in Latin America. It might be more pronounced in Latin America than others, but you see other regions also have high concentration. So these capital markets have developed a lot are a channel in the financing to large corporations. And also, as I said, and Pablo mentioned this, data from Chile on household debt. A big chunk is bank, which is this blue part, but a significant part is financing that goes on from outside the banking system. Here is consumer debt, 53% from banks, but others, for example, retailers, the Falabellas in Chile, is 70% of the credit to consumers. So big chunk of the financing activity goes on outside of the domestic financial system. This is the foreign part I was mentioning. One looks at the amount raised abroad as a percentage of a total amount raised in bonds. In Latin America is 33%, but India 58%. Eastern Europe 60%, Asia 45%. So if one looks at the indicator, typical indicator of financial activity, they tell you just a partial picture because a significant amount goes on abroad. In the case of equity financing, Latin America is very internationalized. 50% of the financing activity goes on outside the country. So just by looking at the domestic indicators, we are missing a significant amount. This is a measure of value traded abroad. Latin America, 55% of the trading activity goes on outside the country. This is a value trade. So half of the activity, this is 55% of the total trading, of the domestic and international trading. So half has gone in domestic market and the other half outside the domestic market. And this is trading by depositor receipts, but let me skip that one. So I think that this activity that has been going on in the capital markets, that you see a lot of internationalization of capital markets, and only basically big corporations are accessing capital markets, has produced a change in the banking system. So even though the levels of the financial financing from the banks to corporations has been low, I think there has been a change in the composition. As the big corporations are accessing these capital markets, these banks are moving downstream to financing first consumers and then SMEs. And now they are moving with SMEs. We did a survey asking banks whether they had an involvement with SMEs, and in different countries, we see that they do have an involvement. And in terms of the type of involvement, part of it is giving credit. Another part is getting deposits, but another chunk is selling services to SMEs. So banks are selling a lot of services to SMEs. So if one looks up, for example, from the corporation side, what is the proportion of firms that have a deposit or saving products? In different countries, most of them have kind of the basic type of accounts. Many have term loans, and different type of loans. Factoring is important in some, and leasing in different countries. And also, if firms are using a significant amount of services and products, for example, insurance, payments of wages, taxes, etc., transfers, etc., they are using banks a lot, firms. Even though they might not be receiving credit, they are using the financial system substantially more than before. And this is the evidence with respect to access. If one looks at the the predicted versus the actual number of accounts controlling for some common factors, and here we have the LAC 7 countries in red and the rest of LAC in green, the picture one gets from this study that we have in our report is that Latin America is pretty much on the line. That doesn't look from analyzing this evidence that is too much below what is expected in terms of a account. But as I was mentioning before, Latin America is more expensive. This is the median chicken account annual fees in Latin America vis-a-vis the rest, and Latin America looks more expensive. One looks at the credit use. Also, one sees that Latin America is even above the line in terms of the actual versus predicted number of loans per 1,000 adults. And this fees are still a little bit high, although more comparable to others. And this is the firms use credit in Latin America more than in other regions. See the use of credit products in Latin America compared to the rest, compared to Asia and Eastern Europe. And Latin America is not that bad in terms of how much they use those products. And the percentage of working capital financed by banks, again, Latin America is not that bad. I mean, it's true that it's low. It's a low percentage, but I don't know what the right benchmark is. But if one compares to Asia, Eastern Europe, Latin America is using the financial system substantially, at least as much as the others. So what I conclude from all this is a very nuanced picture. Here is a very useful report. I think it has a lot of useful information. But I think we need to understand this type of evidence much more. The report helps in our understanding of where Latin America stands on financial development and access to finance. But as I was mentioning, we need much more work. As Liliana also was saying, we need to understand all these issues much more. Overall, the picture, I think, is more complex than many people have in mind. There are new sources of financing. Capital markets seem to be working for, at least for some firms. Domestic financing is only part of the picture, in some cases only half of the picture. SMEs, I think, are attracting more interest, and there is much more progress in access to finance than we had before. And here it depends on whether we see the glass of half full, half empty. I think in Latin America, the report tries, I think, stresses more the empty part. I think there is also some progress in this area. So I think that I look forward to seeing more work and more discussion in this area. Thank you very much.
Is this working?
Hello? Working?
Yes, it is. Well, thank you very much. That was phenomenal. We have like 15 minutes left, sadly. I guess I could ask a number of questions on what truly is a very interesting set of findings. I would just like to mention one issue that has hardly been mentioned throughout the discussion, but I think, I have to think that has a bearing on some of the things that we've seen here, which is the issue of informality in Latin America. I mean, when you have an issue, when you have a region where in some countries close to 50% of productive units are outside the formal system, I would imagine that the obstacles for those productive units to have access to the financial service are considerable. And also when you have, in some countries, 50% of the labor force in the informal service, therefore, with very, I would say, reduced availability of collateral and things like those. So I would like to, I would like us to pay a little bit of attention to the relationship between financial access and informality. And other than that, I would like to open up the discussion to the audience. I would kindly ask you to identify yourselves when you ask a question, and by all means, try to be brief. Okay? There are mics around. In the back.
Hi, I'm Tony Sennett. I'm actually with U.S. Southern Command down in Miami. And I don't appreciate the weather up here today.
Can you speak a little bit louder,
yeah,
please?
My name is Tony Sennett. I'm with U.S. Southern Command, and my interest is in the informality. I wonder, based upon what I've read from Hernando de Soto, for instance, in his extensive research, which echoes some of the themes that you've got here with regard to access to capital, I wonder if the lack of documented collateral, such as the problems with owning real estate formally, or tax evasion, if those are substantial factors in lacking access to the formal capital system.
Thank you.
Do you want to collect questions?
Yeah, I would like to collect perhaps, three or four questions, and then we can bring it back to the front.
Good morning. My name is Amanda Sheldon. I'm a graduate student in the development program at American University. I have two questions. One, I'm wondering about remittances and the interaction between people who are foregoing interacting with the financial system and relying upon remittances. There's a small percentage of remittance receivers that actually use those to start businesses, but I'm curious about that interaction. And secondly, I have a question about Central America, which I noticed there weren't any Central American cities in some of the charts you showed, and I'm wondering about if I know that regionally, obviously, those countries were included, but if we looked sub-regionally, the Andean region versus the Southern Cone versus Central America, what the sort of differences would be in financial access.
Thank you.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Alana Marcelli. I'm a graduate student at Georgetown, and I was wondering maybe thoughts on reversing capital flows. So instead of capital being siphoned from rural markets, being like ideas on ways to put it back out.
So
just possibly suggestions on ways to move capital back out to rural areas, perhaps through agriculture, value-added chains.
I was struck, Carlos Indaco, George Washington University. I was struck by figures in the initial presentation about the cost of informal loans, 272%, I think, return per year. And I wonder how much that relates to the fact that, one, it is far more accessible, and two, it is far more short-term, so that 272 is not something that people really meet with in their economic operations. This is something far more related to daily activity, weekly payments, and that sort of.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The ball is on your court.
Okay.
Let me
but,
thank
but feel free. I mean, the other speakers. You know,
let me thank Liliana and Sergio for the comment and for all of you to be here and for very interesting questions. Just very short. Liliana, we are working with your the data for you. We are going to, we are doing new surveys each year, and we keep some smallest, but part on financial access. So you will have the data. Sergio, you mentioned a very, very important thing, which is, you know, I try to show you data that suggests that families in Latin America and firms, firms is not that strong, the evidence, compared to, you know, to firms in other regions, as Sergio was saying. But at least on the family side, access to simple things as bank accounts, of course credit, but saving accounts, etc., is low. One thing is to show you this data and to suggest that this could imply a problem. But, you know, it's to state in a very credible way that this low access to financial services, behind that there is a lost economic opportunities, and that the financial system is not working well, and that if you give these people, let's say, an account or a loan or a saving services, these people will, you know, will develop, will have more economic opportunities. This is the ultimate test to say that we have a problem with the financial development in our region. And to do that, you need first good data, yes, and then, and second, you have to to perform kind of analysis in which you can certainly say that low financial development causes underdevelopment and causes economic problems. And this is not easy to do. As Sergio was saying, we try in our report to summarize some analysis for, let's say, Asia, like papers by Duflo, etc. We did something on Colombia with the micro-establishment survey, and we show that in counties in Colombia, and district in Colombia, in which you have much more development of the financial institution, microfinance institution, there is much more activity on the micro-establishment of micro enterprises, more employment, etc. But, you know, to do that in a credible way, you have to have the right data. And ideally, you have to perform like experiments. Give some guys some money and others not, so you can have a credible comparison group, etc. So that we need a lot more research, and we are trying to deal with that. But your point is very clear, and we take that. Informality, yeah, that's a big thing, and that's why the microfinance revolution developed in the region, because many of these micro enterprises that get some loans from NGOs, from, you know, credit union, etc., they cannot go to the formal, to the commercial banks, because they don't have accounts, they don't have any collateral, etc. So that's why the microfinance revolution is there, because these guys, many of these guys, are potentially good creditors. But you know, you have to replace the traditional thing to have collateral, you know, statements, financial statement, with the idea that you have a group that will ask, you know, will support you if you cannot pay, etc., etc. So that's why the microfinance revolution. I mean, to give this informal sector some services, some credit. Let me go to the remittances issue. Right, there are some evidence that families that get remittances through the financial system get some access to other services. So actually the remittances thing was an issue that facilitated access to finance services. Capital to rural areas. Well, this is a problem, of course, because this is, you know, our services on cities. So yes, our measure of financial access, this 51%, mm-hmm, is, of course, an upper limit for a national figure in which you have, of course, the rural areas. So this is very important. We don't, we couldn't go to the rural areas, but on the policy side, there were some experiences of public banks that have tried to, you know, do some microfinance things on the rural areas. But this is a whole thing that had to be done. The idea that the financial access can be facilitated because if people have, you know, their own house, so they can use it as a collateral. Well, there is very little evidence on it, but the very little evidence that there is over there suggests that having a house is not has not been important in terms of giving these people access to credit. I mean, having a house have improved a lot, many other welfare things like, you know, schooling, health, etc. But not access to credit. Okay? Not access to credit. Mm-hmm. That's it. I mean, I don't want to, you know.
Liliana.
Yeah, okay. On two of the questions. First, the issue of informality. One of the reasons why I was presenting the results from that those regression analyses, and I was including different factors, including social factors, is because I'm of the view that sometimes informality is quite endogenous to what happens in the rest of the system. Distortions in the labor markets as well and in taxation are incredibly important to make informality a decision.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
For example, I always say that if I were a worker or a small entrepreneur working in Brazil, I would be in the informal sector by choice. It's incredibly distorted, the market and the taxations in the Brazilian system. Without that, it's in the benefit of the entrepreneur to be informal. So the issue of informality is very complex. There is the part where there are constraints that make you be informal, but there are also incentives to be informal. And so I think that I would like to underline that. On the question on access, improving access to finance to rural areas, well, I was mentioning you the study that we are doing at the Center for Global Development. That focuses, given that we don't have so much information as we don't want, that focuses on studies, on case studies, on initiatives. And there are initiatives that facilitate increased access in the rural areas. Some are related to, most of them are related to the use of technology, like mobile banking, for example. And the best case are South Africa and Kenya, actually, out of the region. But you have one of the best studies or the best success stories in Brazil through non-corresponding banking. Mm-hmm. I don't have time to get into these initiatives. But that is another angle of the issue of access, particular initiatives that, by the way, the examples I just mentioned are all private sector-led.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me add a couple of points. With respect to the issue of informality, I think the issue is very important. We have talked to banks, and they argued that it's very hard to lend to firms that are informal because they don't know the balance sheets. Also, these firms have contingent liabilities because they are informal, so they have these contingent liabilities with the public sector, even with the workers. But aside from that, I think that both banks and the public sector are all making efforts to deal with this issue of informality. For example, in the case of banks, they are using collateral. We mentioned the issue of houses, but buses, for example. Buses are something that they can be collateralized very easy, or taxis. And you put a load check there, you cut the service. Mm-hmm. If the person doesn't pay, you repossess the asset very easily. And banks are lending a lot with this type of collateral to informal sector, to taxi drivers. So things can be, they have made a lot of efforts there. Also, the public sector is making a lot of effort by making payments through the financial system, so the banks also know the workers and they get some history, and then based on that they can produce lending. Even in the case of Namfinsa that was mentioned here, in that case, large firms tell the banks which small firms are worthy. And they do reverse factoring. Perfect. To try to deal with these issues of informality. So I think both the financial sector and the public sector are finding ways of dealing with this issue that are kind of efficient. They are not in the first best, for sure, but I think a lot of progress has been made. On this issue of remittances, there is a lot of work that has been done at the World Bank in the finance group, in the research department, that is looking at how these remittances are being channeled through the financial sector and how they are being used and whether they foster financial development or not, and those issues. And there is a lot of work on this area. And with respect to the capital flows to the agricultural sector, I mean, the agricultural sector in many countries
is net saver. They are full of with the soybeans, etc. They have a lot of resources, and they are the ones investing, and they don't invest a lot in the financial sector because they don't trust it. They are leading this boom in real estate in many countries. Mm-hmm. So I think that the issue of problems of access in the financial, in the agricultural sector, in some places is not as severe as many people might think.
Thank you. Well, that was very, very sharp and very short. will CAF continue working on this line of research?
No,
will
yet.
You replicate the survey?
No, we as I say, we are doing this survey annually. And of course, as our topic changed, we keep the financial services part of the survey smaller, but we are doing that. But we are trying to do the other thing around it. We are trying to get some partners in the region, financial institutions, to try to understand this is the idea of whether financial development causes, you know, economic improvement. And that's why we are trying to convince some banks, for example, to do kind of randomized kind of exercises in which, you know, for some clients, you change the loan contract, give more, a little bit more flexibility, and not to other ones, and see whether these changes, whether the people how the people react, whether they talk more loans or not, do they continue in their own relationship, etc. So, but you see, we just are getting the picture, but still we are far from understanding the, you know, deepest problems, as Sergio was saying. For that, we need not only to get the data, we need partners in regions to do a lot of research and analysis.
Well, thank you very much. That was very, very interesting. If you collect more data, let us know.
No,
because
of course.
That kind of
everything is on our page, web page. That even the data can be downloaded. Okay.
If there are more findings, let us know, because this kind of work is very germane to some of the things that we are doing here, particularly the issue of the expansion of the middle classes, which is something that the Latin American Initiative has been working on for some time now. So I want to encourage you to join me in thanking our terrific speakers. I want to thank CAF again, and thank you all for coming.